Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 109 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight. With me is my usual co-host, first, Rob Mark. Hi, Rob.
Good evening from the massive Jetwine studio outside of Chicago, where we've gotten rid of the crickets this year.
Outstanding.
This month, I mean.
Outstanding. Glad to hear that.
And how did that happen?
Well, this is a very democratic community, so we did what any good Democrat would do. We sat down, we talked to them, we tried to make them understand how we felt, and then we negotiated a solution. Didn't work, so we had to kill them, but that's okay.
But they're gone, so that's good.
Locusts are gone.
Good.
All right.
All right, that was also the voice of Dan Webb. Hi, Dan.
Hello, good evening, everyone.
And we've also got with us David Vanderhoof.
Hi, guys. Hi, listeners.
Hi, David.
Hi, David.
Hi, David.
Hey, David. Woo! Airplane Geeks historian. Woo! Yeah! Woo!
You know, I like the...
Do you have a mute button for Dan, Max?
Well, yeah, it's specially programmed.
I just wondered.
David, I kind of liked the Vanderpedia tag that we saw floating around recently.
Well, I really like that blog posting, but evidently the main target who it was geared to hasn't read it yet, or he really isn't speaking to me.
Maybe we can fix that. All right. Our guest today is Gavin Werbeloff. Gavin is an aviation enthusiast. He tweets as travel_Buddha. He's active on the online aero community, initially through Fleet Buzz, I guess, and then Flyer Talk. And he's written a few pieces for travelcrisis.com. Gavin, welcome to the podcast. Wait,
thank you very much.
Wait a minute. Isn't that redundant, Gavin? Isn't every travel trip a crisis?
A crisis.
Not necessarily, and it's through the eye of the passenger.
Okay. Seems like a crisis to me, but...
Well, the eye of the passenger, that's the eye that should be viewed through, I would think.
Yeah, but, you know, then you could also get someone who works for the airline, and all of a sudden your flight's been canceled, and they're 15 minutes you know, after their shift ends, and it's not a crisis for them. They just want to go home.
That's right. Well, I also understand that you have an interest in the dysfunction of the airline industry. What do you mean by that?
You know, there's so many things that occur in the airline industry that just wouldn't make sense within the realm of standard business.
That's for certain.
For instance, this, you know, obsession, you know, disconnected from, you know, normal operating profits with market share.
Ah, yes.
And so where you would normally see a back and forth between fares and capacity and, you know, moving along variance with that and profitability would be your primary driver. All of a sudden, airlines are obsessed with, you know, how many passengers they could possibly take that they left at the gate. And oftentimes leads to too many flights, too big a plane, things like that.
Right. All right. Well, we'll be talking more about that shortly, I'm sure. Coming up, we have David's This Week in Aviation. We also have the Australia Desk Report from Steve and Grant, and a bit of listener mail. We've also got some free promotional codes for the new World Airport Data iPhone application, and we'll see if we can give away a few of those out a little bit later. But first, let's start with the week's aviation news. Are you guys ready?
Give me like 20 minutes or something. I'll be fine.
Our first story comes from Aviation Week. This is only two bids for KCX. U.S. Aerospace and Antonov is out. Well, you can only go so long without talking about the tanker. And something interesting happens, and of course, it has again. As we know, we've expected bids from Boeing and from EADS, or EADS, and those two did submit their bids. U.S. Aerospace, representing Antonov, attempted anyway to submit a bid as well, but they missed the deadline, maybe just by 5 minutes. David?
Do I have to?
If you were writing a movie, you couldn't come up with this.
Actually, the ironic part of this story is the same thing happened on December 7th, 1941.
Okay.
A wire from the Pentagon saying that there was possibly an attack on the Pearl Harbor Naval Base from the United States Army.
Right.
This was the days before they actually talked about intercommunication between services.
Mm-hmm.
The poor bicyclist carrying the Western Union telegram to the admiral happened to be stopped at the front gate and arrived 7 minutes too late to warn of the impending attack by Japan.
Wow.
Repeat, go back to 2010.
Yeah.
And the poor company messenger for U.S. Aerospace arrives at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base half an hour ahead of when the package was due.
Right.
And was stopped by some lone sentinel who had nothing better to do than to keep him occupied, and therefore it was stamped at 2:05, therefore being late.
But wait, there's more.
Go ahead,
yes.
Dan.
From the blog of Stephen Trimble from our last episode, U.S. Aerospace has now filed a protest with the Government Accountability Office, just further prolonging this process.
It's amazing. I think they're claiming that, you know, they were held up, that they would have been able to deliver the proposal by the bid deadline, but that because of the actions of the guard, they were
apparently late. According to the protest, they're saying that the messenger was given incorrect directions on base, and that the entire time their messenger was just following directions from Air Force personnel. So it's not really their fault for being late. It's like they're saying the messenger was on base on time and that the Air Force dropped the ball. That's their claim.
And fast forward 10 years when they actually win the bid and, you know, they deliver their first plane to the wrong Air Force base.
Right.
The Air Force does have a point. If you have a multi-million dollar bid.
Billion dollar.
Multi-billion dollar bid.
Right.
You think you'd have it there a day early.
Which is exactly what Eads did. Eads delivered it a day ahead. Boeing came in the same day, but much earlier in the day. Shaving it down to the last 30 minutes, man, that's pretty close.
Besides, I mean, you really can't trust delivery services. Look at how long it's taking Dan Webb's wings to get to the Flight Global office.
You mean you still didn't fix that darn thing, Dan?
No, they were not late. It's just I ordered them, and the manufacturer said a 4 to 6 week lead time. They got it done in 4 weeks at the lower end of that at that range, and according to FedEx,
why didn't you just buy them a new airplane?
Well, still, it would have been that long of a lead time.
Okay, all right, sorry.
And that plane is a bit priceless too.
Yes. That's so I want to keep the fuselage, get the new wings. Right now, the new wings are sitting in some FedEx facility in West Virginia and should arrive gloriously in the Flight Global offices on August 10th. So,
and for our listeners who are so interested in the saga of Dan and his broken wings, we will provide the tracking number on our website so that you two can verify that the wings actually got back to the Flight Global office.
Very good.
Have I sufficiently sidetracked the tanker conversation?
No, I think we're done with the tanker, unless there's something else you'd like to add.
No.
The only thing that I would add is that the whole way the thing is panned out is just really sad. A friend of mine from graduate school was a C-5 pilot and then ended up shuttling around one of the head Air Force generals. And his point was that they just needed the planes 5 years ago.
Right.
And it didn't, you know, they could have split the order and the Air Force, you know, could have gotten 10 and 10 or however many they, you know, 50-50. And, you move on. But now we've been replaying this thing for so long, and, you know, they're still flying 707s.
You're absolutely right, Gavin. I mean, it is a serious matter. We make light of it just because it's just so comical. But in the end, it's at the same time very sad.
It's fine. The KC-35 will keep on trucking along as long as they keep making duct tape.
Yeah. All right, our next story comes from the Business Journal. This is SkyWest might be interested in Calm Air.
I'm sorry.
Do you have something to add? Or?
Well, I was wondering, could we possibly do the SkyWest ExpressJet deal first and then do the Calm Air thing after that? I feel that might be a little bit more natural.
You being natural is very important to us, Dan, so we'll start out with the item from USA Today.
Thank you.
Regional airlines SkyWest and ExpressJet agree to join. So SkyWest, which according to this article is the largest regional airline, has agreed to pay $133 million in cash for ExpressJet Holdings. That would, according to this article, consolidate most of the regional flying that's done for United and Continental Airlines under WestJet's umbrella. So is this a natural, Dan? Was this easy to see?
Yes, because SkyWest tried the same thing 2 years ago and it didn't work out. The fact that they're repeating it, I don't think really shocks anyone. Maybe I'm wrong there, but I guess just seeing it again in exactly two years time, not surprising. But I think this is an interesting play by SkyWest. First, I mean, it does diversify their portfolio with SkyWest basically being split 50-50 between Delta and United, and with a little tiny bit to AirTran up in Milwaukee. But I think this is a very interesting move if Continental United happens, which I think it will.
Mm, sure.
Well, because I decided, of course, because this is what I do for fun sometimes, decide to make a graph and figure out who, in terms of seats, has the most market share in a combined airline.
Okay.
In terms of regionals?
Yes. So the big, who would be the biggest United Express carrier by regional parent company? And this is assuming that, you know, everything stays as is today. So that includes like the extra 10 ExpressJet ERJs that are being flown for United this summer. And it also includes, just because I threw this in, just because with the regionals, it's kind of fuzzy, I included any flying that SkyWest does for United at their own risk. That's not under a capacity purchase agreement. But even when you exclude those things, you get the same result. But when they're included, SkyWest, and this is rough because with some, sorry, I know I'm really not, but this is rough because some of the private regionals, it's hard to get an exact fleet count. But assuming everything stays as today, which is a big if, but right now, if you just merge the two, Continental Express, Continental Connection, United Express, SkyWest-owned airlines would make up about 68% of those seats.
Pretty substantial.
Yeah, they become very powerful. I think a lot of increased bargaining power there. It makes them, with so many aircraft, a little bit hard to replace them. I think the big thing is that, you know, it just makes them so huge. I mean, if the combined airline, because ExpressJet is just, you know, so big. It was, until only a few years ago, the only provider of jet regional service for Continental, what used to be a subsidiary of Continental. The combined airline will have almost 700 aircraft, which just by, not in terms of seats, but just in terms of number of airplanes, makes them one of the largest in the world. A very big player for United in the future. It'll be interesting to see how that pans out. I think this is also a different response to what's changing the regional industry right now, is that it seems, just from what Republic has been saying over a couple of years, is that the regional business isn't, you know, what it used to be. That, you know, a few years ago, 50-seat jets made a lot more sense. Mainline carriers were giving great deals to regional carriers. So I think Republic decided, our response to that, let's start dabbling with mainline service with Frontier Midwest. I think SkyWest, it's a slightly different response, some kind of consolidation in the industry, reduced number of players. That being said, I don't think there's a consolidation in terms of network, at least, you know, that the mainline carriers generally decide that. But just in terms of reducing the number of competing suppliers in the industry. But I also think an important thing here is, even though, I mean, 50-seat jets aren't as attractive as they used to be, this is a good deal for SkyWest, because part of the deal was a new 10-year capacity purchase agreement with Continental for, I believe, 206 airplanes, which is, I think, as many ERJs are Expresses flying for Continental right now, but I'm not sure on that. So they have 10 years to worry about this. And then plus, SkyWest, ExpressJet hasn't given an exact number in their SEC filings, but Continental holds the leases for a very big chunk of the ExpressJet fleet. So SkyWest is even on the hook for these airplanes. So, I mean, it'll be interesting to see how they merge in ExpressJet. Like I said, smaller RJs aren't in vogue as they used to be, hence the entire ExpressJet E-135 fleet being grounded right now. But I think the big question remains, and this won't be solved for a little while now, is how the heck will the scope clause look at a merged United? Because right now, Continental is a very restrictive scope clause. They cannot have 70-seat jets like United. That's why, I mean, the Q400s are a great airplane, but if Continental for a 70-seat airplane to be operated by a regional partner, the Q is their option because it's a prop. United, on the other hand, has a load of 70-seaters. So it'll be interesting to see exactly how scope turns out as the two pilot groups and the company, negotiate. And I think that will really define the future here. But I think this is a very interesting move by SkyWest.
But Dan, let me ask you. Oh, go ahead, Gavin.
Oh. No, I was curious in terms of scope. If they left the entities as is, wouldn't the purchased airline, the purchased carrier, maintain their existing contract?
Right. No, they'll be the same contract. But I guess what I'm saying is, would eventually ExpressJet, its merged in ASA, would they expand their 70-seat flying? And I think that would happen eventually.
Well, if I can ask, I'm a little curious to either of you airline geeks, because I'm actually getting a little bogged down with all the various scope clauses. We have the negotiation that broke off essentially between the companies over the United mainline and Continental mainline pilots. And then we have a separate scope issue between the SkyWest and potentially the ExpressJet guy. I mean, how in the Sam Hill are they going to keep all this stuff straight?
I have no idea. I'm a little, I sort of looking back at the U.S. The U.S. Air America West merger, then to the Delta Northwest merger, and now to the Continental United merger. I'm a bit amazed and sort of looking for a reason that Delta Northwest went so smoothly in the pilot negotiations. America West U.S. Air is still a mess years later, and Continental United is so acrimonious already.
Well, maybe I'm just naive and youthful, unlike some other co-hosts. There was that little, a little talk in the media about negotiations breaking down between United and Continental. But, a couple weeks later, they reached a transition agreement. I don't believe scope is part of that. I'm not sure. But they at least, they seem to be moving.
Well, no, when you talk about scope, are you talking about mainline or regional?
Well, it'd be part of the scope clause, would be part of the mainline contract.
Okay. The one interesting thing that I noticed about these three potential mergers is looking at fleet overlap between the two, as opposed, is towards the smaller end and the larger end. Because when US Air bought up America West, you had 100% overlap of the purchased carrier into the purchasing carrier's fleet types, and so you had a whole bunch.
Well, not entirely.
Almost entirely. There were all A320 family and 757s coming out of America West.
True, but I guess having the second engine type on the 320s.
That aside, looking at Delta Northwest, what amazed me is that how little overlap there was, especially towards the big end of the plane scale.
Right.
You had 76s, you had A330s, you had 777s, and you had 747s. I can't help but wonder whether part of the reason we're hearing noises out of Continental and United so early on in regards to pilot seniority integration has to do with the fact that they both have large 777 fleets where they have large sets of senior pilots who stand to sort of be at the losing end. At least some of them do.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make any sense?
It does. I'm letting that marinate a little bit in my brain right now. That's going to take a little while. Feels good.
Is scope two way or one way? I mean, is there any way that the regionals can expand and poach on the territory that the mainline airlines currently enjoy?
Oh God, they already have.
Is this really what SkyWest is? Is that their long term plan? Do you think?
What do you mean, like to be a competitor to?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, SkyWest does do some of its own operations, but on regional routes that are at risk, it's under a prorate agreement. But they're generally not competing with a mainline partner there. It'll be branded as a mainline partner, but SkyWest has the risk. And if a passenger connects to mainline, they'll generally get a little extra piece. I think I mean, I never want to count anything out, but I think I don't see that happening. I don't see this as aggressive as like what Republic has done with Frontier and Midwest, which is still very much a work in process.
If they started ordering C-Series, I think we'd all change our tune very quickly.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. And I'm just wondering, you know, if SkyWest is amassing potentially this kind of, you know, power and influence, I'm just wondering how they're going to wield that power.
I think with having such a big operation, I think when it comes to negotiating new capacity purchase agreements, I think it gives them a bit more power. And then just to get back to Gavin's point, I'd be interested to know how close some of the senior 777 pilot groups are close to retirement. But I'm also wondering, I'm just not sure what's exactly in this transition agreement between the two pilot groups that was announced. I'm not entirely, a whole lot of that wasn't said publicly. So I'm wondering, maybe there are probably some pilots who are listening, you know, better than I do. I'm not sure how that mixes in with seniority and scope and whatnot. But I just know that there was some noise, but now they have this agreement in process. It's this tentative agreement. Well, not a tentative agreement, sorry. A transitional agreement in principle. Sorry, I should not use the word tentative like that. We're talking about labor stuff.
Okay. All right, let's move on and talk about Southwest. We see from Bloomberg Business
Week. Whoa. We're skipping the Comair story now?
Ah, okay. All right, we also
Hey, Max, are we going to talk about Comair?
Let's talk about Comair. And in fact, we can learn more about that from the Business Journal, which has an item called SkyWest Might Be Interested in Comair. So SkyWest's CFO, Brad Rich, says that competition in the airline industry means carriers will have to find efficiencies through consolidation. And the Delta spokeswoman, Kristen Bauer, says Delta has stated previously that we do not have to own our regional partners to derive value from them. We want to ensure that each partner airline is independently positioned for success with a competitive cost structure, and we continue to explore alternatives. So, I guess
is that PR for please get this albatross of Comair, you know, away from around our necks?
Yeah, that's kind of what I was giggling at there, because I thought that's what it meant too.
There was this good guest post on my blog a couple weeks ago by this weird guy that we don't know called Courtney Miller. But Court wrote about why Comair wasn't sold with Compass and Misaba that Delta owned, and why it's a little bit more unattractive. And I don't know what's changed with Comair in the past month or two that really makes it more attractive than just unless Delta just, I guess, makes it really cheap for SkyWest to buy. I don't know. I don't know what's different now that makes it that much more attractive.
The other thing that I was thinking of as you were talking about just the sheer amount of market share that if SkyWest would hold, if they paid the $133 million, is that if Delta wants to get rid of Comair and they have a willing buyer in SkyWest, but the whole deal gets killed off by antitrust just because the proposed carrier would just hold such a massive market share as a regional carrier.
Yeah, I'm not sure exactly what approvals what green lights they need. Regulatory.
I would assume they need FTC.
Yeah.
Well, you're the one with the JD, so you tell me.
I'm not an expert in antitrust, but it would just seem that a carrier that big that did, you know, something north of 70% of flying for the two biggest airlines in the country, and all, you know, two of the biggest airlines on the planet, would have enough market share that Congress would probably get a little interested.
It begs the question.
Yes, it definitely begs the question. I don't know what the answer is.
Okay, let's move on now. You guys ready? Southwest Airlines. July traffic is up 3.4% at Southwest Airlines. This is from Bloomberg Businessweek. Also, passenger revenue per available seat mile rose between 17 and 19% from July a year ago, that being 2009. Sounds good, doesn't it?
It does sound good. I don't know what the state of their fuel hedges are, but as oil has sort of moved around, right. You know, granted, a lot of the other carriers have caught up, and more people are flying, so it allows the fares to come up a bit. But it's definitely a good sign for the economy in general to see RASM coming up like that, especially for an airline who's got such a tight handle on their cost structure like Southwest.
Yeah, so you would kind of expect them to sort of lead the way in this regard, I guess, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Well, this isn't just a Southwest story, though. I mean, Continental's estimated PRASM increase was a bit higher, and U.S. Airways was right around the same range as well. So it just seems, right around the same pace that everyone's setting. And this is partly because we've seen these great double-digit increases just because the numbers this time last year sucked so hard, to use the technical term.
And also a lot of carriers pulled capacity out of the market.
Yes, yes.
I would say, yeah, factor. So it'll be interesting to see how, because right around when you're comparing to July, August of 2009, that's where, the year-over-year comps were really the worst. And as we head into the fall, they'll get a bit harder. And Allegiant's already seeing that. For example, their estimated June increase was, I think, was double digit. I forget where it was in the teens, but it was down to single digits for July. So it'll be interesting to see. In terms of traffic, I'm interested it's good to see growth, but it seems maybe we're starting to peak a little bit because not all the carriers are out yet. But Continental, for example, saw a decrease in domestic passengers, and I think U.S. Airways did as well, but I'm not sure on that one. So it seems, load factor also not really moving a whole lot year over year, but hovering around record levels, though. So I'm still mulling this one. But it's good news. But I think what a lot of carriers said in their earnings calls was that we're seeing strong increases, but comparisons are pretty easy. They're getting harder. And we still don't have a good read on the economy.
So we need to watch for a few more months, and in particular, we need to watch what some of the other carriers do.
Yeah. So the carriers that have been reporting revenue estimates, Continental and U.S. Airways both had double-digit growth as well. Allegiant had single-digit growth, and then we're still waiting on United, which gives a revenue estimate, as well as JetBlue.
Dan, do you know if ancillary revenues are included in RASM?
Ah, a good question, sir. Yes and no.
Can we define RASM for those of our readers, our listeners, who may not know what RASM is?
I would tell you what an AIM-9M was. I'm thoroughly confused.
Okay. Go ahead, Dan.
RASM is revenue per available seat mile.
Thank you.
Does that clear? Do I need to define available seat mile too? Or
yeah, go ahead.
Okay, so available seat mile is just a measure of capacity. So to get the amount of ASMs per flight, I would multiply the total number of seats on the airplane times the number of miles on the segment, and revenue passenger miles would be the number of butts in the seats times the miles, and then you divide revenue passenger miles by available seat miles, and that's how you get load factor. And then RASM would be your revenue per the available seat mile. But the other way to get that is to do revenue divided by revenue passenger miles, which gives you yield. And if you multiply that by load factor, you also get RASM.
And these are standard measures throughout the industry.
Yes. Well, what's interesting is we've seen different measures lately. For example, RASM sometimes is just passenger revenue per available seat mile. That's what Continental calls their RASM. But a lot of other carriers call that PRASM. And passenger revenue generally doesn't include ancillary revenue. But that's one thing, actually, Gavin, that United has been noting in their financial releases, is that some carriers report differently than others. But what U.S. Airways does, they report PRASM, which is generally mostly ticket revenue. But they also report TRASM, which is relatively new, which is total revenue per available seat mile, which will include ancillary revenue. Yes. Okay. Yes. So, ancillaries definitely, they're definitely a little bit, it's a bit, makes things a bit messier to track. And that's why, actually, Allegiant, not on a monthly basis, but in their results will, break down, average revenue per passenger. They'll break it down with, what's the ticket price, what's the ancillary, especially with someone like Allegiant, where ancillary is such an important part of their business.
So have you got that, Rob?
Yes. I think our readers are... Keep calling them our readers. Our listeners will, too.
So you're saying there are people
I'm reminded why I became a history major.
Yeah, good. From the Manila Bulletin, Airbus A350 gets Asian boost as Cathay endorses Jet. So Cathay Pacific. It is Cathay Pacific still, right? Yes, Cathay Pacific.
I remember her.
Yes.
She was very nice.
Was that in high school?
Yeah, Kathy Pacific. Yeah,
sure. You need a fly swatter sound effect and a bum bum sound effect.
The drum thing. Right? Okay, sorry.
Yes, I remind all listeners that when you're listening to the podcast, please have a Firefox or Chrome or an Explorer tab open to instantrimshot.com.
Yeah, there we go.
In fact, if I could just interrupt with a funny story from Oshkosh that you guys just reminded me of. I was somewhere, and I think I told this to Dan, that I met someone who recognized my voice. I was in a line for food, and I was talking to someone. He said, "You're the guy from the Airplane Geeks." And I said, "How do you know that?" So I recognize your voice. He said, "You're the smart aleck, aren't you?" I said, "Yeah." I said, "Okay."
He nailed that one. So my
number's up. Anyway, I thought that was kind of funny. Okay,
that's good.
Go ahead.
So Cathay has signed a letter of intent to buy 30 of the A350s, and this brings the total number of firm orders to 535 aircraft from 33 customers, and deliveries start in 2013. So we don't see a lot about the A350 in the press all the time. I mean, there's other things going on that seem to get more attention, but the A350 is kind of rolling along here.
Yeah, you know, I read the press release that Cathay put out, and they were very deferential to both of the airframers, to Boeing and Airbus, saying it was a very tight competition between the 787-9 and the A350-900. My read on this order is a little different. Addison Schoenland over at IAG and John Ostrower, Our friend, the flight blogger, did a podcast.
Friends of the show. Let's just
friends of the
drop.
Show. Yes, friends of the show. They did a podcast a couple days ago on this, and you know, the crux of their conversation was that this is a big warning light to Boeing, which it is. But I don't think that we should read too much into it. The A350-900 is sizably bigger than the 787-9. It's really on par with a 777-200,
right,
or an A330-300, which Cathay has 30 plus of. I think they've got 31 plus another 30 odd of them in Dragonair. And I really see the A350-900, this order, as a one-to-one replacement, which works really well for Cathay because it means they're split between the two major airframers. You're going to have cockpit commonality for their A330 pilots to move over to the A350. It's going to be a fairly simple exchange. But the interesting thing is that this is a plane that's sort of slated for an 8,000 nautical mile range, and it's replacing an A-market plane in the A330-300, which Cathay uses as a real workhorse both regionally and all their Sydney flying, which are all 8-hour flights. Are their A330-300s. And so Cathay's really not going to be pushing the limits of this plane's sort of spec performance, which puts them in an interesting position because it means they can take earlier units that are, even by Airbus's own admissions, going to be overweight and underperform, and they're still going to fit the mission that Cathay really has them for.
So are they like first in line now slot-wise?
I don't think so, but I think, you know, Cathay really got burned by the A340-600. They were really not happy with the ones that they ordered. And my understanding is that they went in very, very cautiously. And while the 787-9 probably would have given them some better efficiency over longer ranges, the size factor was important for them because they do operate both 777-200 and 777-300 A-market models, the shortest range ones. And so they really need that sort of 5,000-mile max range bracket, and they need it to do what they needed to do at certain efficiency levels. And so I think they needed the size of the A350-900, which is why they went with it, is my take.
So is this a sign, though, that Boeing needs to have something that, you know, either an upgrade or a total replacement for the 777?
What's really interesting is this whole talk about, we saw Emirates, when sort of in conjunction when they put in their order at Farnborough, talk about a 777 advanced for the 777-300ER, which is becoming the mainstay of Cathay Pacific's ultra long haul fleet. You know, to JFK, to LA, to Toronto, to Vancouver. This is what they're really pushing towards, and they're by all accounts really, really happy with them. And so the 300ER is still sort of in the sweet spot right now, but the 200, the slightly shorter one, is in a bit of a difficult situation because the sort of counterpart to the 777-300ER is the 777-200LR, which is a really ultra long haul plane, and is a bit of an overkill in terms of spec for most of these missions. So Boeing has to figure out, are they going to build a 77-10? Are they going to, you know, do a new wing or a composite body 777 advance, 200 and 300, which would fill that need. But with the existing 787-8 and -9, you know, selling well, although production issues are still production issues, and the 777-300ER being really the go-to plane at this point in time, the 777-200ER, that sort of B market range slot, is a big question mark for Boeing.
I think it's interesting that the A350 is only available with the Rolls-Royce engine. GE's got some interest in powering that, but so far Airbus has not been receptive to the GE NX engine.
Yeah, I mean, but on the flip side, on the 777-200LR and 300ER, they only have the GE option. I think part of the reason that there's been some jockeying back and forth between Airbus and GE on this is because of the largest variant of the A350 family, the A350-1000,
right,
is sort of trying to be the successor to the 777-300ER. Which has exclusivity with the GE90 engines. And so I think GE doesn't want to undercut their own product by offering an engine for the A350. Also, there my understanding is that there are limits on how much the core of the Gen X, which would be, you know, the sort of the engine that would go into the A350, how much it can be scaled up. My understanding is it could be done for the A350, 800, and 900, but the 1000 is sort of beyond the scope of what it's capable of doing.
Yeah, that's the sense I get from some of the press reports, yeah, as well.
There also exists the GP7200, which is the engine alliance, the Pratt-GE joint venture that powers the A380. But my understanding is that there's an EU rule regarding engine alliance engines that they can only be used on four-engined aircraft. Or something to that effect. That there's a regulatory hurdle to putting the GP7200 on an A350.
Okay, let's talk about goings on in Zimbabwe. this is kind of amazing. This is from the telegraph.co.uk. The civil aviation authorities in Zimbabwe, they did a great thing, I guess. They decided that they were going to have a, you know, aviation disaster test. And they initially said that a Boeing 767 had been involved in some kind of an accident while attempting to land at the airport. In fact, they even confirmed that there had been some injuries to some of the passengers. Well, of course, this started freaking everyone out, trying to figure out, well, what plane was this, and are my relatives on some flight to Zimbabwe, and are they involved in all this? And it turns out that it was just all part of the drill. It wasn't until 90 minutes later that...
No, this wasn't a drill. This was fiction. This was a lie. This was insanity.
This is a drill. I repeat, right. This is only right. A drill.
Well, yeah, but nobody broadcasts to the media that there has indeed been a crash when no one has ever done that I've ever heard of in any kind of a simulation. They may say, okay, this message has been given to the media... And then you hold up a copy of it and show everybody what the media has been told, except you don't really tell them. That's crazy.
Well, this was pretty realistic. I mean, we had smoke rising from the airport. We had police and paramilitary soldiers blockading the, you know, access to the, quote, crash site. It was all very, you know, realistic, which is, I guess, a great way to test your response. But, you know, it was just handled in a very bizarre way.
I think bizarre is being nice.
I think it was just a Jerry Bruckheimer production.
I hope they have good film.
That movie will be out next year. Disaster in Zimbabwe.
Yeah, yeah.
Otherwise known as Airport 2010.
All right, we do have one GA item to talk about.
This is when Rob's supposed to go, yay!
I'm still reacting to the Zimbabwe thing, to tell you the truth.
You're just all torqued up, aren't you?
Well, you know, I guess I'm sorry. You know what really irritates the crap out of me about that story?
What?
Is that the rest of the media bought it. I mean, they reported it as if it were
real.
You have to remember, the media in Zimbabwe doesn't report anything unless Robert Mugabe tells them to, or Robert Mugabe approves it.
Right, so that's why the rest of us that are supposed to have our heads screwed on straight are supposed to say, gee, you know, guys, let's confirm this somewhere before we run with this.
Yeah.
But everybody wanted to be the first to tweet it.
No, I think you're absolutely right.
All right, I'm sorry. We'll go on. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Okay, AvWeb tells us a school launches aging aircraft maintenance site. So this is a new website, and the idea is to provide one-stop shopping for general aviation maintenance information and for help maintaining aging aircraft. Rob, have you taken a look at this? Is this?
Why are you talking? Wait a minute. We're talking about aging aircraft, and your first response
this goes straight to you.
What is that
straight
about?
Straight to you, Rob.
Oh, sorry.
Never even a pause.
Am I overreacting?
No.
Oh, no. Okay.
I guess Moses strikes again.
There we go.
I'm sorry, Max. What was your question?
So this is something that the Wichita State University's National Institute for Aviation Research has set up. This is called the Aging General Aviation Education and Training website.
It would make sense for something like that to be in Wichita, given that there is as much aviation industry in that area as there is.
Yeah, I think this is a great idea, and at Oshkosh, this actually made a little more sense to me. Because there was a fellow ahead of us when we did our social media seminar talking about aging aircraft and how it's very much like getting old as a person, that it doesn't mean it's very much like getting old as a person, except that the airplane doesn't need to die at some point like we do, but that things just wear out. But it doesn't mean the airplane has even begun to see the end of its useful life.
They can practically replace and rebuild anything.
That's right.
It's just a matter of what airframes is.
Right. It's a matter of what the look is that the customer is willing to accept. And people are spoiled these days. They see a Cirrus with nice, big, roomy, comfy leather seats and glass cockpits, and they don't want to get into a 172 that's 40 years old, even if it is refurbished. But there are an awful lot of people that are going to take this to heart because the cost of flying is expensive, and I think this is a way to help keep it down.
I mean, is there something to be said for having a newer plane and fuel efficiency and the sort of cost delta between buying something used and fixing it up and buying something new that's inherently more efficient, that you know, over X amount of flight hours, the cost will make itself up?
Well, you know, I think that if you were to look at it as you might a turbine airplane, I don't think the comparison works. A new Cessna 172, I forgot how much it is. I think it's $275,000 or something like that. And you can go out right now and buy a used one, an older one, for probably $35,000. You could put a brand new engine in it and a brand new glass panel in it for, God knows, $30,000 more. And so for the cost of, you know, perhaps one quarter of what a new one is, you would be only slightly slower than a new generation 172 because they have not really gotten any faster. So the efficiencies, maybe they might burn a gallon of fuel less per hour, if that. But again, the cost comparisons are just silly to even discuss sometimes. Again, I think most of this comes down to the fact that people just don't want an old airplane because it's gotten to be too much like buying a used car.
Is there also an issue of preservation, though, keeping these older aircraft? you know, available and just not letting them die out.
I think there is an element of that. If you're up at Oshkosh or Sun and Fun or any of these regional shows, you'll see people that have classic airplanes. I mean, really, really old airplanes that they've taken meticulous care of. And as far as they're concerned, they don't mind the fact that they're Cessna 170 is 45 years old and it's polished aluminum and they just love them. But those kinds of people, I really think these days are few and far between. I think that more of the people that are learning to fly are looking at it from one, either a career perspective or as someone who is going to use an airplane in business. And they're not going to use a 40-year-old airplane in business.
Yeah, good point.
So, again, you know, I you know, from a philosophical standpoint, though, I still believe this is an important organization to get going, though.
And the website is aginggeneralaviation.org.
And no, my picture is not on the front.
Not
so
yet
do not even think about that.
Just out of curiosity, what is the smallest plane anyone's been in?
Smallest.
Not including, you know, paragliders and ultralights.
A decathlon.
Okay.
Yeah, I'd say maybe a Cessna 120. I used to instruct in one of those. That's pretty tiny.
I sat in a BD-5J, barely, but it didn't fly.
Yeah, right. I was in one of those, too. I forgot about that. Yeah, that is, well, that's small, but actually I think it weighed more than the Cessna 120 did, so.
And how about you, Dan? What's the smallest plane you've ever, was it a Boeing?
Well, hold on. I'm trying to find, how are we doing smallest? Are we doing it by seating capacity or doing it by weight?
Seat pitch.
Dan,
if you have to go that far, then.
Because I've been, the smallest is probably a Fokker F-28, but I believe.
Hey, no swearing.
But I believe even though it holds more, I think it might be a little bit lighter than a CRJ, but I'm not sure. So either the Fokker F-28 or the CRJ 200.
In other words, you haven't been in a real airplane.
is a 747 not real to you?
Well, if it's got four seats, that's a real airplane. You might actually get your hands on the grip.
Yeah.
I had a leg in a Rockwell Shrike Commander.
Well, actually, I got to sit in a Citation Mustang at Oshkosh, if that counts.
Yeah, until the security guards came and got you.
No, it was part of a press event.
All right, I think that's it for the news.
I think that's it for the news.
Again, our guest today is aviation enthusiast Gavin Werbeloff. Gavin, again, thanks for coming on the podcast.
I'm excited to be here.
Now, you know, one thing I wanted to ask you is an enthusiast who's been around some of the message boards and, you know, forums, things like that. Can you give us a rundown? What are some of the places that you like to hang out online, and what are some of the places that other folks might enjoy hanging out?
As a frequent flyer and long-haul flyer and someone who's trying to, you know, find all the best ways to not pay for extra luggage or to get into the lounge or get upgraded, Flyer Talk is definitely the message board to go on to. Just there's such a wealth of information. There are people who really have read the fine print of the frequent flyer agreements and the contracts of carriage and can really be a gold mine in terms of maximizing your flight experience.
And that's a very active board, as I recall.
Oh, incredibly, yeah. Incredibly. I about a year ago, I went off on I actually bought one of the famed Round the World tickets.
Oh, yeah.
And went off, and that was Flyer Talk has, you know, both airline by airline and their message boards for each of the major alliances who are the ones who really sell the Round the World tickets. And just such an incredible wealth of information for anyone who is considering doing something like that.
Mm-hmm.
You went around the world. How long did it take you to do that?
I did. I flew a staggering number of miles last year. I'm a first generation American, and my family is literally scattered around the globe. And so, anytime there's a family function, it requires at minimum a 5-hour flight, and that's if I'm lucky. I think I use Flight Memory, which is a great little website, and my most common leg is between L.A. and London Heathrow.
Hmm.
I sort of ran into the brick wall known as the global financial crisis after finishing graduate school, and my lease on my apartment was up, and I decided that rather than blow through savings moving to a big metropolitan area where I would be looking to find a job when no one was hiring anyone to do anything, I would get myself an around-the-world ticket and, you know, spend 4 months backpacking through lots of places that I'd really wanted to see for a very long time.
That's great.
Which is what I did. As finance people would say, the opportunity cost was very low. No one was hiring anyone to do anything in the fall of 2009. Yeah. Never mind, you know, in the legal field.
What's the dumbest thing you've ever seen on a flight?
Dumbest thing I've ever seen?
I gotta hear this one.
God.
Yeah, I know. I'm hitting you cold with that, I realize. So
some of the things that sort of boggle the mind that I've seen a few times. One, the size of carry-ons that people try and get on flights. I was on a JFK LA flight, and someone literally tried to bring in like a 28-inch wheelie, you know, a big wheelie. It's like, how'd they fit that thing through the x-ray machine?
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that sort of, and as someone who buys, you know, restricted tickets because, you know, they are cheap, the whole idea of you know, people showing up clearly too ill to fly because if they tried to not show up or change their ticket, they get, you know, whacked around by the airline. But they're clearly too sick to fly, and then the flight gets delayed by an hour because the airline has to pull the people off a long-haul flight that they were too sick to board in the first place, and the only reason they showed up was because they'd lose their ticket.
Yeah.
You know, it's just sort of where logic does not reign. Let's see. One of the coolest diversions I've seen was Dan and John's little jaunt between Dulles and Reagan National last week.
Oh, that was fun. That was fun.
So what was that all about?
Oh, what happened was John and I were flying back from Oshkosh, and we were...
Your first time flying back from Oshkosh, Dan.
Yes, the first time flying back from Oshkosh. So we were on our way back, and so we flew Appleton to O'Hare, and then we're flying O'Hare to Washington National just because... for the both of us, National was more convenient, and apparently the weather was just a mess. The airport was just nothing was near the airport, and so John and I were listening over Channel 9, and you know the pilot says, "Well, we really can't hold for as long as you're living. Give us a you know an update. So let's just divert to Dulles now." And so we landed Dulles. A lot of people get off after United. At first, wasn't going to let people off, but they changed their mind. So we found a jetway operator. Blah blah blah. But John and I said, well, a cab ride's expensive. It's going to take a while. So they're going to continue the flight on the National. So let's just stay on board because we're going to earn mega dork points if we can do this. So, yeah, we did the 23-mile flight from Dulles to National. I'm sure it was obviously a lot longer because that's the Great Circle distance. I'm not sure exactly how long we fly. I don't remember.
You actually looked up the Great Circle distance on that thing?
Yeah. I think it's 23 miles.
Google map it?
Well, I wanted to find the exact, you know, nonstop routing.
You are a geek.
I'm sorry.
Very precise.
Yeah, so that it was fun. We didn't climb over 7,000 feet. It was cool.
You know, short flights, one of my favorite flights that I did quite a bit growing up in San Diego was San Diego, L.A. Before the era of regional jets, those were all, you know, little Saab prop planes, and there's something really nice about just scooting up the coast below the cloud level, and being able to look down on the coast coming up between San Diego and Los Angeles. It's a really pretty flight.
Oh yeah, the view's got to be terrific.
Oh, fantastic!
Well, my dumbest flight ever was John Wayne to LAX.
How'd you pull that? A diversion?
No, actually, it was a scheduled flight. It was my wife and I were flying home from our honeymoon. We flew on a American Airlines 737, took off out of John Wayne. Now, John Wayne has their power takeoff throttle back. And basically, it's the closest thing to an Immelman I've ever seen done with an airliner. We took off like a rocket and then proceeded to be in final approach to LAX. I thought my shortest flight ever was, it used to be when I used to fly up to visit my brother in Toronto. We would fly Philadelphia to Buffalo, then Buffalo to Pearson. And that was always a comic flight, because the flight from Buffalo to Pearson was just long enough for them to feel obligated to serve food, but not long enough to actually do it. So basically, the flight attendants would come down the aisles and very quickly lob juice containers at you to be able to get all of them feet people served. And all of the and as the flight attendants got to the end of the aisle, at the end of the airplane with their juice containers, another flight attendants were rapidly walking down the aisle, stealing them out of your hands, throwing them in the trash bag for because they were preparing for landing.
Yeah.
So those are my two really dumb flights. But the rocket launch out of John Wayne to final splashdown at LAX was really kind of an interesting flight.
Also, just to add, while the great circle distance between Dulles and National was 23 miles. Oh, no, actually, you know what? Hold on a second. Give me a second. I'm sorry. The great circle distance is 24 miles. It's 23 nautical miles. But we no, wait, hon. Ooh, great circle distance says 24. FlightAware says 23. Controversy. But we actually flew 89 miles, because I knew everyone was caring about that and really on the edge of their seats. So you may now return.
But don't they give you a minimum of a 500-mile credit?
Yeah. You know what? I haven't logged into my Mileage Plus account since that flight.
Yeah, make sure you get those miles.
I once had a strange diversion. I was on a Heathrow to LAX flight on Virgin, and we had a flight attendant medical emergency and had to divert to Reykjavik.
Wow.
And we sat dumping fuel for an hour over the North Atlantic, because we were maybe an hour and a half into the flight on a full 744. And had to sit dump fuel for a while, and then land, let the sick flight attendant off, refuel, and then head on our way to LAX. The really kooky part of that whole thing was that it was in the 1 week of the year when the time change between London and Los Angeles was extended by an hour. So we landed at our original landing time without any wind help, solely because of the extra hour of time we were afforded.
Can you imagine how much that cost those United when they dumped all that fuel? Oh, my God.
It was terrible.
I have to point out...
Easy boy. Down boy.
You okay, Dan?
I did not get any miles for that diversion flight. So just to, again, reduce the – I know all the listeners were caring about that one. Oh, God, I drank something the wrong way. For the second week in a row.
Take it easy, Dan. Take it easy.
How is everybody?
Hey, let's play a little word association with Gavin.
Okay.
Anybody want to start? Well, we know what Dan's doing. I can start. Gavin, here's mine.
Okay.
Addison Schoenland.
Nicest guy on the planet.
Now, you used to live down the street from him, right?
Yes, I did. I did. I've known Addison for a very long time.
And was he kind of an influence in your...
Definitely. Definitely. You know, I'd be walking down the street and, you know, he'd be outside his house. And, you know, I was a little, you know, I was 12, 14 at the time. And, you know, we'd hear the sound, you know, whoever was taking off overhead. And, you know, he wouldn't even look up, and he would tell me exactly what plane it was, solely based on the sound of the engines.
Oh, cool. Addison's got a great podcast. Love listening to that.
Yeah, you know, we were talking about a lot of the websites and message boards, and particularly the ones that sort of talk about the airline business, not necessarily the experience, and a lot of the planes and everything. Mm-hmm. A lot of people, there's a lot of conjecture that goes along with it, and a lot of people sort of think they know what's going on and know the engineering aspects to it. And some of them really do. But what's great about Addison's website is that he really gets on the guys who really do. I think I've heard some really cool podcasts with him. The guy from Aviation Partners Boeing, who build the winglets, just a ton of really cool, really knowledgeable people. He gets to come on and speak with him.
it's a great source of really good information. So thanks to Addison 100%. For that. Yeah. David, have you got a word?
Since he spent lots and lots of time in cabin, and I haven't eaten dinner yet, how about in-flight catering?
Ambien.
Ambien?
Okay, so can I do my word now?
Yeah, go ahead, Dan.
Awesome. Just because, Gavin, since you're a California guy, so you probably, you know, have a better feel on the market than I do. So my word association is actually the name of a company, California Pacific Airlines.
That's the one they're trying to start, isn't it?
Yeah. Yes. The word that I would use is ambitious. Because they're sort of trying to resurrect the PSA network, doing it with Embraer, I think it's E-170s or E-175s?
E-170s, yep.
E-170s out of Carlsbad.
Right.
Which incidentally is a SkyWest destination out of LAX. It's one of the ones where they put their own flight number on it. I'd love to see him succeed. And I as the sort of smaller planes go, I love the E-jets, the Embraer E-jets, the E-170s. Mm-hmm. But it's going to be a tough slog, especially out of Carlsbad.
That's my question, because I've heard that Carlsbad is great because that's where a lot of the people who are using San Diego anyway, a lot north of San Diego, this will be awesome for them. So do you see a market there, I guess?
I really don't know. I really don't know. San Diego's airport situation is completely dysfunctional because you've got it's the busiest single runway airport in the country. The second busiest single runway airport in the world after London Gatwick. And they're sort of heading towards max capacity, and there is no consensus or even remotely, you know, we're not even close to having consensus on where to go next with it. As heavy a Southwest city as it is, I think it's going to be a tough sell unless the schedules really meet your needs.
Okay, Rob, have you got a word for Gavin?
Well, of course, it's the old story. I can't come up with a word. I was going to say worst destination.
Hmm.
Huh. Place that I've actually flown. We're talking places that I've actually flown to.
A destination that you have flown to that was. What's the worst place you have ever traveled to?
Worst airport or worst place? Because the worst airport is very easy.
Oh, well, okay. Let's do both. I mean, can I have both, guys?
Of course. Start with the airport.
What's
the worst airport?
Worst airport. Granted, I was transiting through, so that it adds complexity. But De Gaulle, transferring flights at Paris Charles de Gaulle is an absolute nightmare.
Yeah, I'd have to go.
Really? Because when I did it, because I've only done it, I've done it a couple of times. It's not too
It depends
bad.
Which airline you're on.
I was going from Air Europa to Air France, and it took me 2 hours.
Remote parking at De Gaulle is horrible.
Wait, how long did it take you?
2 hours.
Wow. So I was on Air France all the way, so it wasn't that bad. Okay, got it.
Okay, and the worst destination?
Where I just was so happy to get on the plane to go home.
Was that when you were hanging out with Dan?
No.
Oh, no, that can't be because you haven't met Dan. That's right.
No, I haven't. Dan and I have only spoken and tweeted, although that doesn't stop me from bullying him and giving him hazing. For being the intern and for breaking airplanes.
I'm very impressed by that attitude, actually.
It's laudable.
I really am. Because when I met him at Oshkosh, I promised at lunch that I was going to turn over a new leaf and I was going to be better to him. But I've since changed my mind because I think that'd be really boring.
Well, he has to still meet Max.
Yeah.
If Max still has to be Max, that's right.
If Max starts being nice to him after they meet, then we've all got issues.
Max, take him on the boat.
Yeah.
I think I finally got it. Probably
okay, right.
Ontario, California. I had to spend a few days in Ontario, and I recently moved from Southern California to Northern California, and so had to fly down to Ontario rather than just taking the 10 freeway. And that was just an unpleasant experience. Buffalo is a close second.
Buffalo, New York.
Buffalo, New York.
Uh-huh.
Favorite airport would probably, coolest airport was definitely Hong Kong. But coolest experience ever.
Wait, whoa. Old Hong Kong or New Hong Kong?
New Hong Kong. I have not been I have not been to old Hong Kong. But I didn't go through that landing. But what I did get to do, I was 7 years old and somehow managed to wrangle myself into the jump seat for landing on an Aero California DC-9 coming into San Diego.
Hmm.
It was very, you know, it was a long time ago. I was 7 years old at the time. But
still remember that.
I still remember sitting there and thinking, A, how did I do this? And B, this is so cool.
All right. Very good. Gavin, thanks again for coming on the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
Tell us where we can find you online.
You can find me on Twitter at travel_Buddha.
Very good. Okay, is there anything else that you want to talk about that we didn't cover, Gavin?
The three McKinsey Airlines.
Uh-huh.
You know, TED, Song, and Jetstar.
Right.
It's interesting to look at why Jetstar has worked and TED and Song had very short lives.
What do you think is the major features that resulted in that?
I think it's because Qantas really operates it with a separate crew, a separate crew contract, separate airplane, separate aircraft, separate everything, and it allows them to keep their cost basis low enough that they can really sell at much lower prices. Delta got a lot out of Song. If you look at what they've got now with their in-flight entertainment offerings, Song really developed those for them. With the live satellite TV, and they were really pushed in that direction, but they never really got enough separation. Both Song and TED never really got enough separation from the parent carrier to sort of take advantage of having a lower cost basis and being more competitive in that aspect.
Okay.
So I think that's really interesting. I'm curious if we can post some questions to Plane Crazy Town Under Gents. And see if they can dig around, because you know one of the things that I guess is if it's new, it's JQ. It must be JQ, is what they always say. And it seems kind of interesting that I'm aware that Qantas created a whole new subsidiary called Qantas Cabin Crew Australia, which holds all the contracts for all their new cabin crew. And I'm curious what the sort of distribution is between mainline Qantas and Jetstar, because I know that all their 380s, the cabin crew, are all QCCA. From what I understand, there's a pretty big difference in the cabin crew contracts. And I'm not sure how they're sort of moving new generation contract cabin crew in to replace the old ones. But my understanding is that British Airways, who have close ties to Qantas, kind of want to start moving in the same direction, which is a big sort of undercurrent in their labor unrest that's been going on for the last 6 months. It's definitely low-cost carriers. We always thought of them as low-cost carriers because their fares were low. But I think what we're seeing is that it's their cost structures that allow them to sell the tickets cheaper and still be profitable.
Right, and that's where you want to be in the end.
Yeah, and so you sort of look at cabin offerings versus cost structures. I'd really like to see Virgin America succeed because they really are doing something different in terms of their in-cabin offering, and they've got new planes. They've got a low enough cost structure that I really think if they get enough economies of scale going, I'd really love to see them sort of push the rest of the carriers into get them out of the death spiral in terms of, oh, it's all just a commodity, lowest prices, and your onboard experience doesn't matter.
Right. We don't need that.
No. And I think when Continental United were dancing, US Airways got referred to as the ugly girl or something to that effect. And in terms of the carriers that have gone down that sort of cut model the most, US Air has all the in-cabin offerings of a of a low-cost carrier, but the cost structures of a legacy, which is – so it's pretty easy to see why they were referred to as the ugly girl.
Yeah, sure.
Well, I think on a stage-length adjusted basis, what they've always said, and I've heard other people in Bandai that say they still have a cost advantage like relative to network peers, and that covers their revenue disadvantage. But I'd say at least on some of the international routes, I'd say their new Envoy suite that they've been investing in is a very strong product.
Yeah. I mean, granted, they only have, what, 4 A330s and a few 767s?
Well, the 767s aren't getting any of the love, but I think every A330-200 has it at this point, I think. And then soon they're going to start the retrofit of the 300s.
Interestingly enough, apparently Cathay is going to be installing that same Sigma Cirrus premium product as their new business class. Huh. They were in the Contour Premium with the herringbones along with Air New Zealand and Delta and Air Canada and Virgin Atlantic. Apparently, those along with their fixed hard shell economy seats have really not taken off like they wanted them to.
Well,
And so those are getting shifted out. So it wouldn't surprise me if their A350s had that product.
It was a pleasure having you on, Gavin.
Thank you guys very much for having me on.
There's a new iPhone app out that's called World Airport Data, and the folks that produced this sent us a few free promo codes. But just very quickly, it's a very simple application. It's compatible with the iPhone, the iPod Touch, and the iPad. It does require iPhone OS 3.0 or later. And with this application installed, what it'll do is give you airports and some data about airports. First off, if you allow it to detect your location, and then it will show you airports near you, not just strictly the United States. But whether you look at airports that are near you or just search the list of airports, it shows you obviously the name, the IATA code, the location, the elevation, some information about the runways, the elevations, frequencies that are used, and also a map. You can click on a link that will show you a map of the airport. I don't know if this is pulling this off of Google Maps or something similar, but you can zoom in, zoom out. It's a very simple, at this point, easy-to-use app. It's not very expensive. It's just $1.99 in the iPhone store. But we do have some coupon codes. So what we'll do is offer those up to listeners. And I think we'll just make it simple. Send us an email at thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com and just tell us that you'd like to put your name in the hat for this World Airport Data iPhone app. And we'll select randomly just a couple of listeners and pass along those codes. So check that out.
No, Max, they need to work for it. And after they get it and use it, they have to tell us about them using it.
Well, that's fair. I think that's fair. This is a version 1.0. And so like is often the case, it's pretty simple. If I was going to look for one improvement, it would be for improved searching of the world airports. As it is now, you've got to scroll through a long list. And as you might imagine, there are an awful lot of airports in the world. And so it can be kind of difficult to get directly if you want to look at a particular airport. But otherwise, it's kind of a fun, handy thing. And a lot of detail. When I had it look for airports near me, it actually came up with a lot of not only small regional and grass field airports, but heliports, just all kinds of things. So it's got a lot of detail in it. So send us an email, thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com, and we'll pick some random winners for the coupon codes.
Woo!
Okay, and now here's David Vanderhoof, our official historian with This Week in Aviation.
Thanks, Max. Welcome to This Week in Aviation, Volume 2, Episode 24, August 8th through the 14th. August 8th, 1934, a de Havilland DH-84 Dragon, tail of the Caribou, takes off from Wasaga Beach, Ontario, Canada, to fly nonstop to Great Britain. RAF Captain James Ayling and Leonard Reed of the de Havilland Aircraft Company of Canada are at the command of the Dragon. The DH-84 has a cruising speed of 109 miles per hour. The flight took the crew 30 hours and 50 minutes to complete the journey. Landing at Heston Field outside of London, the flight was 3,700 miles. Sadly, the aircraft G ACIM, was written off in Great Britain after Reed, who was giving rides to afford to send the aircraft back to Britain by boat, clipped some trees at an airfield in Hamble, England. August 9th, 1952, a North Korean MiG-15 attack of a flight of Royal Navy Hawker Sea Furies flying a combat air patrol. The flight is led by Lieutenant Peter Hoagie Carmichael. Carmichael wrenches the Sea Fury FB-11 around, straining its 2,550 horsepower radial engine, and fires on the fleeing MiGs. The four 20-millimeter cannon find their mark and down one of the MiGs. Another MiG in the flight is seriously damaged. The 802 Squadron Royal Navy flight returns to HMS Ocean, with Carmichael credited with the first Royal Navy MiG-15 kill in Korea. August 10th, 1947, BEA, or British European Airlines, begins the world's first regularly scheduled cargo-only service. The flights use Douglas Dakota freighters surplus from the war. August 11, 2003, the Spirit of Butts Farms departs for England. Its 6-foot, 3-inch wingspan was gracefully thrown in the air at Cape Spear St. John's, Newfoundland. The tiny aircraft flew all by itself and landed near Clifton, Ireland. The flight of 3,030 kilometers lasted 38 hours and 58 minutes at a whopping 50 miles per hour. TAM-5 is the world record holder and the first radio-controlled aircraft to fly the Atlantic Ocean autonomously.
This is radio-controlled?
This was a radio-controlled aircraft that flew autonomous, yep. It, wow. 99% of the flight was done by itself.
I hadn't heard this before. That's amazing. Okay.
Yep. First flights that occurred during the week of August 8th through the 14th. The Fiat G91, August 9th, 1956. The Bell XV-5, August 11th, 1975. The Northrop F-5E, August 11th, 1972. The Learjet 25, August 11th, 1965. And the Bell 222, made famous in the television show Airwolf, August 13th, 1976. And that's the way it was. This is David signing off.
Thanks, David.
The didgeridoo means it's time for the Australia News Desk. Here's two of the craziest guys we could find south of the equator. It's Steve Vischer and Grant McHaren from the Plain Crazy Down Under podcast.
No, look, Steve, I'm telling you, even though it's Rob Mark, the Jetwine-led invasion of Australia could be pretty serious, mate. I mean, you know, if Scott Spangler gets in with Rob, we're in deep trouble. You know that.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. Well, you know, it's all right. I don't think he says he's never been here, so he'd probably get lost anyway. He is very old.
Yeah, I know. But, dude, I'm a project manager from way back, and the rule is plan for the worst, hope for the best, okay? So let's see what we can marshal. We've got to marshal the defense of Australia, okay? So first up, the RAAF. We've still got some F-111s, so you can do a great dump and burn right over their heads. That'll scare them, or if at least it'll delay them while they take photos.
Yeah, we could pile them up on the beach, if nothing else.
Yeah, well, there is always that. We've got the new Rhinos, the Super Hornets, and we've got the AWACS. The AWACS is finally up and working with the wedge tails, so we could toast them, fly them in low and turn on the radar, and zap!
We could repel them by sea. What about the submarines? There's the quiet ones and the noisy ones.
No. We lost all the quiet ones. We sent them out on missions, and then we've never been able to find them since.
No, that is quiet.
Yeah, I know. Very quiet. But the new Collins class are just, yeah, I think you can hear the clockwork from too far away. So we're not sure we can use those. Hey, you know, we'll have the army all on the beach ready to go, and I'm sure we can get some surfers out there ready to work. They can go out there and go, hey, smack, you know.
Plenty of dole bludgers out there. We could pile them up on the beach.
Yeah, yeah. Hey, do you reckon we can get the Kiwis to help?
Well, they must owe us something by now. Yes, well, they're closer to America. We could repel them with Kiwis.
Yeah, well, you know, we could strap a couple of sheep with M16s to the hard points on a P3 Orion. Hey, Steve.
Yeah.
Is that the red light on for the Ausdesk recording?
Oh, Struth, we're on.
Oh, God. Dude, you said we were going to watch the time. Okay, hang on. Dateline, August 8th, 2010.
G'day, folks, and welcome back to the Australia Desk. I'm Steve Vischer for episode 109, and with me is the not plotting to take over the world, Grant McHaren.
Hey, how you doing, mate?
Very good. I've just got my pirate patch on here. I'll just take it off. Ah, now I can see the screen.
Oh, my God, did that hurt?
Yes, ouch. Put my glass eye back in. Anyway, Grant, it's been a pretty slow news week here, which has given us time to, you know, advance our plans for taking over the world.
Oh, no, there's nothing quite like world domination.
Absolutely. But in the meantime, we've got a couple of stories we'll put out this week, and then we can get back to the meeting.
Indeed. Yeah, what meeting? No, just let's get on with the stories, yes.
Okay, as I said, it has been a pretty quiet Newsweek aviation-wise this week, but of course never too far from the news are our good friends at Tiger Airways. Ah, correct sound effect. All right. Cool.
Yes, you got the right sound effect, but we may have to change it yet again. I mean, last time we talked about Tiger, we were saying we may have to change the sound effect to a cash register. Now I think we may have to make that cat sound a little bit more Irish, mate, because it certainly seems like Crawford Ricks, the new managing director for Tiger Airways Australia, is trying very hard to be like Ryanair.
Yeah, he certainly does like to make the headlines. And, you know, Grant, I really wish some of these people would just concentrate on running a business properly instead of just trying to make as many headlines as they can. If he wants to do that, he could get into politics. cutting political commentary there, folks. Tiger Airways says that more businesses should follow the lead of the Australian government and ban staff from accruing frequent flyer points. Tiger Airways Managing Director Crawford Ricks made the radical suggestion at last week's Asia-Pacific Aviation Outlook Summit up there in Sydney, and he expressed confidence that Tiger would attract more corporate passengers without adding the bells and whistles of full-service and hybrid carriers.
He'd
be dreaming, I think.
You know, it's the government saying that you're not allowed to accrue frequent flyer points while travelling on their dime. That's caused enough of a hassle within the mandarins in the halls of power. But imagine if they did that in the corporations where, you know, you're not at home, you're being slung all around the world or all around Australia, and, oh, by the way, mate, you're not allowed to collect those frequent flyer points. Well, I think half the people would turn around and say, right, pay me more for this lifestyle. You know, the frequent flyer points is one of the lurks of being sent all around the place for your company.
I don't understand his rationale here. He's saying that he's basically saying that, you know, all the airlines in this country should get rid of their frequent flyer programs as if they're he's actually saying here that they're basically a relic of a bygone era, but really it's a great marketing plan, and I can't see why he would view it as anti-competitive or whatever. I mean, the fact that his airline has chosen not to offer them should be no reason at all why Qantas or Jetstar or Virgin Blue can't operate theirs. I'm sure they do it in the US too, mate, where they do a lot of cross promotion here these days, where you can get certain credit cards and, you know, those purchases rack up frequent flyer points, or, you know,
you're shopping at the supermarket, things like that. Let's face it, he's anti them because he sees them as locking people in. You know, I've got frequent flyer points with Virgin, I'd rather fly with Virgin. He's not really seeing this situation where people have frequent flyer points with any airline and just take what they can get. But Jetstar doesn't officially have a frequent flyer point program, but they do dovetail in with the Qantas one to a degree. Depending on it, I don't believe you can earn points domestically, but you can earn a limited number of points if you fly Jetstar internationally on a Qantas frequent flyer point number. But it's just him saying, hey, this is a blocker, it's stopping people from flying with us. No, Crawford, the reason people don't fly with you is because they hear their friends talk about how bad the experience was.
Well, they listen to our podcast, Grant.
Yeah, well, that too. But I mean, this is the bit that really kicks me over, that he's going down the O'Leary path of, any news is good news and anything that gets our name bandied around is good, because he says that the airline would do whatever it took to offer the cheapest seats profitably. And he's quoted here as saying, so if that means vertical seating and our customers like the idea because we'll be able to offer even lower fares, we'll consider it, and we'll even consider coin-operated toilets like our Irish cousins have proposed.
Yeah, I mean, the guy's not even original, and, you know, if this is the new style of management at Tiger Airways, well, you know, I actually had a bit of hope that when this fella came in that it might actually change a bit of their philosophy, but it seems like already they're showing signs of going from bad to worse. So, you know, as much as we would like to, and this is actually true, folks, believe it or not, we would actually like to deliver some good news about Tiger Airways occasionally. You know, when you hear stupidity like this coming out across the print media and across the airwaves, well, it doesn't give you much cause for optimism.
Yeah, indeed. Because, I mean, vertical seats, they're not going to get through. The FAA and the CAA and CASA and EASA and so on won't approve them because they won't give the G-force protection required for crashes. Yeah, there's all these kind of things. Boeing are resistant to the idea of having taking toilets out because it makes the aircraft harder to resell. All these kind of deals. It's classic. And hey, the Tiger meme is spreading. Thai Tiger is about to take off. That's 51% owned by Thai Airways and the rest by Tiger. And they're going to operate out of Bangkok and do short haul international around the Thai area. So, you know, the meme is spreading. We'll see what happens.
And just as a footnote here, I notice in this article that we're reading here in the Australian.com.au, Grant, it says, Mr. Ricks said the airline was not actively doing anything to attract corporate or business travellers. I'd say he's not doing anything to attract any passengers the way he's going.
Yeah, well, hardly a day goes by down here where you don't hear a Tiger tale, so to speak. And generally, at least once a week, there's one printed up in the news somewhere about someone being very upset by what they've done.
Okay, Grant, one more quick one before we finish up here. It looks like we've got a change on the way to do with mobile phone usage in Australian skies on aircraft. An interesting turn of events here. Now, we did talk recently about the possible advent of picocells coming into, I think, Virgin Blue. We're going to operate them in their aircraft. And it looks like using mobile phones from now on is going to be legal on Australian aircraft in Australian skies.
That's right. The Australian Communications and Media Authority, a part of our government, has gone through and approved phone use based on discussions with CASA, the Civil Aviation Safety Authority, and assessment of the new technologies that are coming on board. Now, I was working with picocells many, many years ago in buildings as a way of allowing people to have their mobile as their only phone. So you'd be sitting at your desk, you'd be inside the picocell, and the call would get routed through into your PABX just like a normal call. But as soon as you left the building, it became like a normal mobile phone again. Very interesting technology. It allows the phones to work on low power so that they're not putting out quite as much RF interference, which can cause some problems, as many of you have flown light aircraft may have heard. If you leave your phone on, you're flying your Cessna, all of a sudden you hear tick, 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 tick over the top of your comms. It can be a little embarrassing. But what they're doing is with these picocells, they're going to allow you to have your phone on. One of the requirements, of course, would be that it's on silent mode. So you can receive SMSs and do emails and all that kind of stuff. Naturally, this comes with a cost. There's a couple of approaches. One may be a provider that's locked down to just one of the carriers in Australia. So you may get on a plane that's only got Optus and you're on Telstra. Bad luck, you're out. The other one is that you have an independent party providing the picocell. So you connect on and they just charge you a fortune for using it, of course. The scary part is whether they're going to allow full-scale voice calls. At this stage, it's tweeting, data downloads, SMSing, things like that. That looks to be an option once you're in cruise flight, all via this picocell, all at rather expensive roaming rates. If they go to full voice, you know it's not going to be long before it's... Now, sir, would that be talking or non-talking section?
You've been practicing that line all week, Grant, I can tell.
Oh, totally.
Actually, if you listen to the episode 37 of Playing Crazy Down Under, where we're talking to the three flight attendants there, one of the common themes there was mobile phone rage and the I can't live without my mobile phone syndrome. So, you know, people are more reliable on them. Let's face it, they're more than just phones these days. In fact, if anything, they're computers with a phone tacked on.
Correct.
For good measure. So, it's good that we're going to be able to use these things in flight.
But, you know, it's not going to be cheap. This is going to cost a lot of money. So if we're really, really lucky, that'll stop the situation of like, oh, hi, yeah, you wouldn't believe what happened to me. Oh, my God. And I said, and they said, and oh, my God, yeah, for real, which would scare the hell out of me if I'm trapped on a plane having to listen to that.
Yeah, that's right, Grant. I mean, they should be all have their iPods on and listening to Airplane Geeks and Playing Crazy Down Under. What's the matter with them?
Yeah, I know. We got to work these kids. I mean, I tell you.
And Grant, you know, speaking of mobile phones, you've had a torrid week this week with your BlackBerry Life Support system being temporarily cut off.
I know. There was a bit of a kerfuffle with a change of providers, and it's been hard reset. And now I can't access the internet on it. And my dude, it's 2 years old. The little nub on it's getting, the little trackball's getting a bit sticky and things like that. It doesn't always work perfectly. So I think it's upgrade time.
Android. Hey, Grant, we need Androids to take over the world.
Yeah, I know. Because then I can go, that is the droid I'm looking for.
Absolutely.
Speaking of taking over the world.
Yes, now where were we? I think we'll see you next week, folks.
Yeah, catch you next week, folks. Meanwhile.
I think we've got to get those guys some therapy. Seriously. I mean.
Well, fortunately, Rob, you know someone.
I do, actually. Guys, Grant, Steve, we got your back there, buddies. You'll be better, really, someday, I hope.
Remember, we're only saying this because we love and care about it.
Right. It's time for an Australian intervention. Of course, last week we were going to have an Australian invasion.
You were going to invade, yeah.
Well, we took it down a few pegs. We don't want to invade. We just want to intervene because we love you, as Dan says.
We'll have a police action.
A police action, yes.
Those are always fun.
That's kind of like flying on Tiger Airways, right?
Yeah. Okay, let's move on to some listener mail. We got a voicemail from Jeff. I've actually met Jeff at a uncontrolled airspace meetup. And had the pleasure of that. Jeff sent us a voicemail.
Hey, Geeks, this is Jeff Ward, otherwise known as Scoffrejet on all the new media channels. Just wanted to say enjoyed episode 108, the post-Oshkosh episode. And Max, you and I met briefly at the UCAP meetup at Barnes a while back, and I met Rob briefly at the AOPA summit last year, but really got to spend some time with him this time at Oshkosh, which was a lot of fun at all the various tweet-ups, meetups, parties, and so on. He was busy. He was doing out there working it, so you can be real proud of him. And the special treat was the opportunity to get together with both Rob and Dan for lunch. Dan was very nice, paid for my Pepsi, which if he learned anything at Bryant, I'm sure he immediately slid into his Flight Global expense report. So anyway, great show. Really enjoyed meeting them and spending some time with them at Osh. And really also looking forward to the Meet the Webs episode, if you know what I mean. Thanks again. Talk to you later. Bye.
That guy was a party animal.
Is that right? Yeah.
Yeah, he's a party animal.
I'm going to say, if my bosses were listening, you can check my expense report. I only expensed what I consumed because I am that, you know, good.
You're such an ethical guy.
Mm-hmm.
Very good. We also got an email from Ryan. Ryan writes in, "Hi, Airplane Geeks team. I've been a long time listener and I'm loving the hour and a half time it takes while I'm at work. I got some questions. One, I live near Willow Grove NAS. And I've been wondering what has happened to it, and I never have gotten a straight answer. Every once in a while, there are A-10s or C-130s flying around, and I'm told it's National Guard. There used to be air shows there every year, but they stopped around 2005 or so. Maybe the amazing David knows this military question." And I think, David, you did answer Ryan on that one.
Yeah, I know a little bit about that base. It would be like asking a question to Dan about seat pitch. Willow Grove Naval Air Station, or the Willow Grove Air Reserve Facility. My father was base civil engineer for 25-plus years at that facility. In 2006, to make a long story short, the Base Realignment and Closure Authority out of Congress decided to close the facility. My dad's unit, the 913th, which was the Air Force Air Reserve unit there, AFRES, that flew C-130Es, in September of 2007, they had a flag retirement, which meant that the aircraft were and a flag, the squadron colors were flown down to the Air Force Reserve headquarters in Georgia. And at that point, they were retired to an archive, and the squadron went defunct. The Navy is in the process of, it had two P-3 squadrons there. VP-66 is long gone. VP-64 became VR-64 and flies two C-130s.
Great. Ryan came to the right place, huh?
Yeah. Some interesting notes. The C-130 that I got my first C-130 flight in from the 913th is now actually flying with the Iraqi Air Force and is one of their startup aircraft. By the end of September 2011, the base will be transferred over to the state of Pennsylvania, and I think basically she will be no more.
Wait a minute, you mean Iraq is going to give us back Pennsylvania? I didn't know they had it.
Yeah, it's a swap for hostages.
Yeah.
Okay, I just wanted to be clear on that.
Ryan goes on saying, "This is random, but I love cars as much as planes and stuff, so I was wondering if you guys could say the cars you have at the end of your podcast." And he also says that Dan says too much. Ha ha.
Ouch.
P.S. Ouch. P.S. He says, "I'm also 16, and I'm considering a career in flight, so I enjoyed your episode on that." Thanks, Ryan. And now Ryan added in later that he drives a 1998 Jeep Cherokee, lifted and stuff, with 210,000 miles on it. So, Dan, what kind of car do you drive?
Well, as of Saturday, when I was in D.C., I was actually carless because the subway in D.C. is just really, really good. And actually, it was fantastic. Sure. I barely missed my car, actually. But now that I'm back home, I am now driving a Honda CR-V.
Oh, outstanding.
Yeah, I at Oshkosh, I seriously considered going to the Honda Jet booth than asking for a discount, but eventually bought better.
So, Rob, do you want to tell the world what kind of car you drive?
I thought that was already well known. My car is unlike Dan's. Mine does not have pedals with big blocks on them. although it has been called a clown car at times. No, I have a 2006 red and white Mini Cooper, and my daughter calls it the clown car, but I don't know what she means by that.
I think that's cool, Rob. That's fitting.
Yeah, it's a neat car. I have to. I owned one of the original Minis. Oh God, 35 years ago when I lived in England, and I never lost sight of it. So when I saw these come up in 2005 for sale again or being produced, I said, "All right, sorry, it's my midlife crisis. Got to have one of those."
That's great, David.
Oh, I my baby is a black Pontiac 2000 Grand Am. In the next month or so, she will have over 200,000 miles on her.
Ah, good for you. And mine is a Nissan Xterra, 2003.
How many miles?
About 170. All right, guys, I think that's pretty much it for this episode.
All right, good night.
Bye.
Good night.
We want to thank again Gavin Webeloff. Gavin, are you still there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Thanks again
this
for joining us,
guys. This guy's a glutton for punishment, isn't he?
I know,
he?
He's just hanging in there.
I enjoy this stuff. I'm sitting here listening, and I normally have to wait until Wednesday to hear all this stuff.
All right, David, tell folks where they can find you online.
They can find me quietly at whatjustflewby.com and soundeffectsless at DM Vanderhoof on Twitter.
And Rob?
You can find me at jetwine.com and on jetwine at Twitter. And yes, it is true that we have blocked Dan from our Twitter account.
Mr. Webb, would you like to respond?
No, I'm too big to
Dan! I'm feeling so tickled. Bye.
Okay, due to the fact that I am tired and want to watch Mad Men, I'm going to just move the podcast along now and say I can be found at thingsinthesky.com and on Twitter at Dan Webbage.
Great, and I'm Max Flight. You can find me at 30,000feet.com and also on Twitter at Max Flight. Be sure to see AirplaneGeeks.com for show notes, listener comments. You can follow us on Twitter at AirplaneGeeks or send us email, thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. You can also leave a message on our voice line.
And if you want to call the Airplane Geeks, you can dial 361-GEEKS-01.
Thank you, Benet Wilson. I should mention opening and closing music, which you're listening to right now, is from the amazing Brother Love. You can find him at brotherloverocks.com. So thanks, everybody, for listening. Go out, tell your friends about us, spread the word. And we'll see you again next time, next week, as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Good night, everybody. Thanks for listening.
See you later.
Thanks. Bye.
Get some sleep, Dan.
More importantly, Mr. Vanderhoof, why have you not eaten yet?
Because I wasn't hungry.
And he didn't want to eat during the podcast.
And, I'm yeah, saying. And I'm, you know,
well, if it's okay for Dan to hawk up along while we're all sitting here, I would think it would be, you know, hearing no. David, you know, quietly chomping on his... On yeah. his
but what you don't know, Gavin, is that this particular show has a long, rich history of people being critical of other members of the cast. Or chomping while they're chatting.
No, I'm just saying, you know, I'm fulfilling my role as, you know, mother of the podcast, and I want to make sure that everybody's eating.
Mother of the... Oh, wow, this ended up it up for...
Wow. Max, tell me you're recording this.
You just gave up intern as your title, and now you peg yourself with mother of the podcast?
Oh my!
I hope Benet is listening to this, so if she can be the auntie. What does she want?
I want to meet Aunt Benet. I really want to meet Aunt Benet.
I finally met her this past Thursday, and it's just funny the way she put it when we finally saw each other on the street is perfect with just this whole social media thing. She goes, "Oh my God, you actually exist." Also, Dave, Mr. Vanderhoof, why are you yelling at me by the chat window?
Because you're making noise.
Oh. Well, he just does it so harshly.
I know. It's that firmness I like because it gets your attention.
Well, I noticed it because this time, on this case, I was trying to relax. So I was just laying down with my phone, and I didn't know I was making the noise, and it startled me.
Wait, you're talking about firmness. Are you talking about, you know, an instant message or a stick?
Well, it's the fact that
are you beating him?
No, it's the fact that it's like in all caps with exclamation points. It's unsettling. I was in a happy place for a little while.
Dan, they're old. They don't understand that when it's in all caps, it's a yell.
No, I think David knows that very well. I think he's just trying to make a point.
I was going to say the same thing. I think he knows.
I think he does.
Where's David right now anyway?
David, you are there, right?
Oh, yeah. I'm just being very quiet.
David, Dan, you weren't nice to Dan. Please, Dan, don't let that happen again.
So next time I will write, please, Dan, you moron, stop making all the damn sound effects.
Also, most importantly, we got 19 minutes until Mad Men starts. So let's get moving.
Okay,
here.
Yeah, we're in danger of running
what
along.
What starts?
Mad Men.
Mad Men.
And the East Coast and the East Coast feed of Entourage out west here.
Yeah, yeah.
But
okay. Wait, Entourage? Who cares about Entourage?
Okay, guy, you just said that you wanted to end the podcast. Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Forget the cast.
Tell me you're recording this.
No, I'm sorry. This is much more important. I'm sorry, Mr. Webelov. How is Entourage more important than Mad Men?
It's not. I'm saying that my preference is to watch Entourage on the East Coast feed, which I can get out west, meaning I can I don't have to DVR Mad Men.
Whoa. Why wouldn't you DVR Entourage and watch Mad Men live, more importantly?
Well, if I can watch them both live.
Max,
incidentally,
didn't we try to get rid of his guest once? I don't think I've ever had one go.
Wouldn't go away.
There's an in New Zealand. There's an epidemic of turning DC-3s into restaurants.
Yeah.
There are. I counted at least four or five going through. You know, between both islands, DC-3s put up onto stilts by McDonald's.
Oh, ouch!
Yeah, perfectly good DC-3s.
Well, they used to be perfectly good.
Yeah.
But they, you know, you're just driving along, and next thing you know, there's a DC-3 on stilts with attached to the playground. It's like, come on, that's blasphemy.
David?
Yes?
Hi.
Is there some kind of purpose to that comment, Dan, or are you just being friendly?
Just being nice.
No, I've got you guys on speaker, and I enjoy this stuff. Dan,
I'm sorry. Well, you know, here's as if you press the dial pad button on the iPhone, it just makes this cool spit effect, and the dial pad comes up, and it's really fun to watch. And
well, David, you live a lot closer to him than I do. Can you go get him?
No, Max is closer than me.
Yeah, that's true. Right. I am.
He's back in Rhode Island now.
I'm gonna have to take care of this.
I'm sitting here listening, and I normally have to wait until Wednesday to hear all this stuff.
Yeah.
So plus I get all the outtakes.
Wait a minute. You mean you're recording this stuff?
Bye.
Now hold it, Rob. He needs to be telling you that if he's going to be the airplane mom, he needs to wish us all a good
that's
sleep.
That's right.
Night.
Yes.
Dan, can you call back tonight and read me a story?
Anytime you want.
Okay.